Join me in welcoming Sheldon. Hi, everybody. I'm Sheldon Fetty. I'm an alcoholic. Now, they say that alcoholics are typically above average intelligence. You should see the look on my friend's face when I told him I was going to Atlanta for 12 hours. I was thinking about that, though, how we're above average intelligence during the countdown, because Robert was reading 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, 4 years. I thought they couldn't have got a guy that could count to 50 to do the countdown. The Al-Anons probably the ones that wrote that list, knowing that there's no way one of us could have done that without it written out for us in order. So I'm grateful for that. And Amanda, the way that you have been the voice is full of energy and is beautiful, and she's done a great job. So Amanda, a guy goes into a bar, alcoholic walks into a bar, and he walks up to the bartender, and he says, "Bartender, I want to buy everybody in the bar a drink." And the bartender happens to own the place, and he goes, "Are you kidding me? There's 40 people in here." He goes, "I don't care how many people are in here, I want you to buy everybody a drink, and you know what? Get one for yourself." So the guy's as happy as can be, pours everybody a drink, pours one for himself, says to the guy, "There'll be $384. He says, "I don't have no money." So the owner of the bar takes him out back and beats the snot out of him. Next night, same guy comes back in the same bar and says, "Bartender, I'd like to buy everybody in the house a drink. Except you, you get violent when you drink." Oh, boy. I live in Las Vegas, Nevada, and if you're ever in Las Vegas, please come and join us at my home group. My home group is Connect the Dots. We meet on Monday night and Tuesday night. We meet on Friday night and Saturday morning, and we would love to have you come and join us at our home group. If you happen to be there on a Wednesday, we have a couple of guys over at the house, and we read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you need directions, John's there most Wednesdays, so please come and join us. So I live in Las Vegas, but I wasn't born in Las Vegas. I was born in England, and I know I don't sound like I was born in England. I've been here a long time. I moved here when I was 16 years old, and I'm not a military kid. I'm born and raised in England to an English family, but over the years, I've lost my accent. I think it's because I'm a chameleon with a keen ability to fit in anywhere that I am. My brother says it's because I have no personality of my own. I think he's probably spot on, But I was born in the north of England to average parents. My parents are not alcoholic. If somehow being born into an alcoholic family gives you some kind of panache or extra credit here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I do not come from an alcoholic home. My mom, last Mother's Day, had a glass of wine. I had to order her the second glass. Right. And then she ignored it the rest of the brunch. I stared at it thinking, "Drink, drink, drink, for God's sakes." My father told me one time, he said he's not against drinking, but it dulls the fun of life for him. Right? What kind of people do I come from? You guys that come from alcoholics, at least you felt like you belonged in a home. I felt like an alien, for God's sakes. But my parents did split up when I was very young. I was 2 years old when my dad left. And for me, it was the biggest tragedy of my life. I come from a Jewish family, and we lived in a Jewish neighborhood. And when my dad left, we lost our home, and my mom and my brother and myself moved into the equivalent in Britain of Section 8 housing. We became a welfare family. We became very poor, and we lived on the wrong side of the tracks. And in Britain, there was a lot of anti-Semitism. And so I grew up being bullied and picked on as a kid because of all the anti-Semitism in England. and I hated my dad, and I hated my family, and I hated everything about my life. And if you would have asked me why I drank the way that I drank, I probably would have said that it was because my dad left when I was two. He ruined my life, destroyed me, and because of that, I hate him, and I hate my mom, and I hate my brother. I hate my neighbors. I hate the people in the Jewish community. And if I knew any of you at that time, I would have hated you too. I didn't like growing up. Didn't like my childhood at all. And when I was 9 years old, there was a kid called Barry. Barry was cool. What made Barry cool was that he was 2 years older than me. He was 11. Right? And so I would have done anything Barry asked me to do. And I'm grateful, looking back on it, that Barry asked me to drink. Because who knows what direction my life would have gone in, right? But that was a tenuous moment in my young life, right? But he did. He asked me to drink, and we stood in front of a liquor store until somebody was willing to go in and buy us some booze, and somebody obviously did, and they brought us a bottle of Old English apple cider, which is just apple juice with a kick. We went into a wooded area. Barry took the screw top off the bottle. He took a big slug on that bottle, and he handed me the bottle. And I took that bottle from him, and I took a big pull on that bottle. And what was to happen to me at that moment was to happen to me almost every time I drank from that day until the last time I drank. I puked out of my nose. I'm a nose puker. Some of you are really good at drinking, right? Some of you are like, you carry the quart of warm vodka in your back pocket or your glove box and you drink all day. And you tell me when you drink, right? When you drink, you shoot pool better. You talk to the opposite sex better. If you're a musician, you play better. God help us all, you drive better when you I am not a consumer of large quantities of alcohol. I am a drinker that drinks till he causes trouble. Our book says that we're often dangerously or disgustingly antisocial. I am not very dangerous. I'm disgusting. I am the pee on the couch, hit on your mom alcoholic is who I am. I'm that guy. I'm that guy. I'm the guy that has three or four or five drinks and I'm spilling everything and insulting everybody and saying inappropriate stuff. I'm a slob and I'm a pig and I'm just really, I love it. I love everything about it, right? You're having a terrible time. I'm having a blast, right? I'm the guy that when you drink your friends under the table, when they get there, I'm already there. Welcome to under the table. It's nice down here. Hang out with me for a while. Right, but something happens to me when I drink that is incredibly difficult to explain. And I try to explain it with this picture if I can. None of this stuff really happens, but emotionally it feels like this happens. So I'm short, right? My son is 15 years old, and he's now exactly the same height as me. And I think that's neat. And he said, "Dad, I'm not done growing. You're little, right?" He's not impressed that he was able to reach below average height, right? So I'm short, and I've always had a weight problem. I'm fat, and I think I'm ugly, and I got a big nose, and I'm this Jewish kid from a divorced home. And I drink, and in that wooded area with that kid Barry, when I was able to hold some of that booze down, what it felt like for me was it felt like my parents got remarried. It felt like I grew a couple inches. Felt like I lost a few pounds. It felt like my foreskin grew back. I always love to watch the signers. Most of these jokes and quips are for you. That one's purely for me. But what what it feels like is it feels like that everything that is wrong in my life gets healed. Right? I'm an awkward, uncomfortable person, and when I drink, it feels like the edge is knocked off. It feels like I can breathe out. It feels like I don't know, like what's wrong with me is I'm just missing alcohol. Right? And when I pour it in me, I become whole again. And I learned that at 9 years old, and I ran with that because it was magical and mystical and wonderful and beautiful. And I tell you, at 9 years old, I made a decision I was going to drink as much as I could from that day on, as often as I could, for the rest of the time that I was on this planet, because it was the answer. And at 9 years old, I didn't become a daily drinker. My mom was kind of strict, and that wasn't in the cards for me. But I drank a couple more times that year, 4 or 5 times when I was 10, 11. By the time I was 14, I was drinking something, taking something, smoking something, or snorting something every single day of my life. And I loved it, and it worked. I heard somebody say from the podium one time, they said that their very, very best day drinking was not as good as their worst day in AA. Now, I understand why they said it. It's a misquote out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I understand what they're trying to get at. But if my worst day in AA is better than my best day drinking, the hell are you drinking? Right? I mean, I've had some pretty bad days in sobriety. My wife and I have one son. We saw 4 heartbeats in order to have one son. Those are bad days. Those days are, boy, they're right up there with my worst days drinking, for crying out loud. We've had some heartbreaks, some difficulties, some financial problems. We've lost people. My father passed a couple of years ago. Her mom currently is battling cancer. We have had difficult days in sobriety. But I tell you, I wouldn't trade any of it. I wouldn't trade any of it for the insanity of end-stage alcohol. Early-stage alcoholism, magical. If it was still doing that, I wouldn't have come to Atlanta for 12 hours. I tell you that for nothing, right? I might have been missing for 12 hours. And I might have come to Atlanta, but I wouldn't have come to hang out with you, right? But it doesn't those early stages were magical and mystical and wonderful, and I chased them. I got this one memory in my mind, and I remember things in pictures and little episodes. And there's this one particular episode where I was in Shoreline Amphitheater, just outside of San Jose, and the Grateful Dead are playing. And I'm on 4 hits of window pane. And Shoreline's a pretty steep amphitheater. I'm at the very back. And it's one of those foggy kind of days, right, where it's not really raining, but you know it really wants to. Right, and the band's on the stage, and it's thundering and lightning, and Bobby Weir yells out, "It looks like rain." And I'm having a spiritual experience, the likes of which no 12-step call has ever given me. And if it still did that, I'd still be doing that. But what happened is somewhere along the line, there was a dirty trick, a joke was played on me. Somewhere along the line, the plug got pulled on the power that came from booze. Somewhere along the line, it didn't matter what I drank or took, it didn't matter. I could have poured scotch inside of me from morning till night, and many days I did. And I was unable to get free like I used to get free. I was unable to fly like I used to fly. I could not find the energy and the power and the magic that I used to find in the bottle. And I tell you, you would think when that happened, I'd have quit. But I got this thing called alcoholism. And somewhere in this mind of mine is this thing that says, well, you know, maybe if we drank somewhere else with somebody else, something else. Maybe if we try harder, right? Maybe we just, we're going through a dry spell, it's going to come back. The idea of me quitting drinking just doesn't enter my mind. And then it does. And then I try. And I tell you, at the worst stage of alcoholism, when booze isn't giving me the freedom, it still gives me the dullness to take the edge off the pain. Because in a state of abstinence, something happens to me that doesn't happen to normal people. When I put down the bag and the bottle, when I put the cork or the plug in the jug, when I set aside the alcohol, something happens inside of me that's very difficult to explain. I get this, it's kind of at a low level. It's an anxiety, it's a depression, it's an upset, it's an angst, it's a knot in my stomach, it's a place where it feels like the world just kind of blows through me and I'm empty inside. I get this, you know, Bill calls it restless, irritable, and discontent. But it's just this, right? And I tell you, when I'm in that state, and that's as good as it gets. Sometimes it gets loud in my head. Sometimes it gets more uncomfortable than that. But in a state of abstinence, on my best day, I'm bored. Right? On my best day, on my worst day, I'm crazy. And the entire time I'm in a state of abstinence, my head's telling me, have a drink, you can have a drink. Just have one drink, have one. You can have one, you deserve one, for crying out loud. You haven't had one for a long time. It's been what? 2-3 days now. I mean, you know, have a drink, just have one. You can have one. I don't want to have one. I'm not going to have one. Why would I have one? I just destroyed my life again. I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm not going to do it. Don't drink, 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 don't drink, drink, don't drink. Screw it, I'm going to drink. And I drink. And then, if we weren't just going to compound things even more with the insanity that happens with me, I take that drink, and it's not enough. Something gets lit up inside of me, and I got to drink the whole damn bottle. Then I got to go get another one, and I'm on the train, and I'm burning my life to the ground again. I have never once woken up in the morning and thought, you know what, my life's pretty good. Haven't drank for 3 or 4 days. Think I'll go spend the rent money on scotch. Right? You know what? Things are going pretty well so far for me. You know what I think I'm going to do? I think I'm going to have. I'm just going to go out and I'm going to call my boss and tell him, listen, I'll be missing for 3 or 4 days. And when I do finally show up, it'll be with guilt, shame, and remorse just to come and get that final check. And I wouldn't have come if I didn't need it so bad to keep the party rolling. Right? I know I said I'd call you, honey, but you know, right? I never planned that. That was never what I set out to do. What happens is that I'm in a state of abstinence and I tell you what I'm going to do. And this makes perfect sense. I'm in this state of angst and I know how to get rid of it. And I'm not going to burn my life to the ground. I'm not going to do it again. Why would I? Why would I? You know, it was different when I was a kid and I'd have these bad episodes and whatever. But I tell you what happened in my life. When I was really young, this will surprise you. I used to sell Ginsu knives at the county fair. But wait, there's more. Right? In case of a weird set of circumstances, what happened was I ended up on QVC and I was a national spokesperson for Kenwood Appliances. I had infomercials that ran. I was on Home Shopping Network. And I was the youngest executive that Kenwood ever had. I was 21, 22 years old. I'm like Wilson. I have arrived. Right? And I keep getting in trouble behind my drink. And I keep not showing up when I'm supposed to show up. I keep showing up for live television shoots with scotch on my breath and my shirt untucked. And they're running me in the back and trying to piece me together and throw me in front of the camera. And somehow I was able to piece it together when it was time to perform. It's kind of like no sleep in 48 hours and showing up in Atlanta, right? It's kind of, some skills don't go away, right? But somehow I was able to do that. And so I was able to keep the job a little bit. But after a while, they got tired of me and they fired me from that job. And when they fired me, I knew why they fired me. There was a guy at that company called, we always know why, don't we? There was a guy called Bernard at that company, and he didn't like Jews. They said they didn't want an alcoholic crack addict as their national spokesperson, but I think that was an exaggeration of what was going on at the time. But I lost that job, got another good job, lost that job, got another good job, and then I couldn't get a job. And now I'm a guy that can't put together a paycheck, and I'm living back at Dad's house, and Dad asked me one thing. He says, please, I know what you're up to. I know what you're doing. Just don't bring it in the house. Come home messed up if you have to. Just don't bring it in the house, and I couldn't even do that. I couldn't even do that. After a couple of weeks of living there, who's he to tell me what I can and can't do? I'm an adult, for God's sakes. So I'm stood on the toilet trying to blow stuff in the extractor fan. I've got bottles hid under the bed and under the pillow. And he finds them, not because he's snooping, but because I'm a slob. Right? I mean, we don't hide stuff well when we're drinking, do we? Right? You don't need to be Inspector Clouseau to find out what I've been up to. I leave breadcrumbs everywhere, for God's sakes, right? So now I'm this homeless guy, and I go into a detox, and I go into a halfway house, and I'm in this halfway house, and when I got there, I was really grateful for those people. They were wonderful people. They didn't charge me any rent for the first 2 weeks. They didn't even make me owe it to them. It wasn't like on account. They said, you can have 2 weeks free. And at the end of the 2 weeks, if you're actively looking for a job at the end of those 2 weeks, you won't owe us the money. We'll let you stay. If you don't, if you're sitting on your bum, we're going to throw you out. If you're actively looking for a job, we'll let you stay 2 more weeks. If you find a job in the next 2 weeks and you go to work and you're working, we'll wait for your first paycheck before we start to charge your rent. These were wonderful people. They gave you breakfast and dinner. They let you take sandwiches for lunch. AA members would bring cigarettes into the facility. This was a halfway house like none I have ever heard of before or since. These were good people that were just trying to be helpful. I'm there for 26 days. And I want to know who the hell these people are to tell me what time I need to come home. You know what I mean? I mean, let's not forget I'm homeless, but I still think I'm the executive, you know, host of... who are you to tell me what to do? They wanted me to do a chore. Now, I got to tell you, right? I mean, I understand why Punky in the corner needs to learn how to clean the bathroom. Right? But I know how to clean a bathroom. Do you? Have you ever done it? Well, no, but I'm sure it can't be that hard. And I'm not doing it. And so I leave the halfway house, and what starts next is the worst 3 or 4 years of my life. About 3.5 years, I get drunk to get sober, to get sober, to get drunk, to get drunk, to get sober. I get a week here, 3 days there, 2 days there, a month there, 3 days here. I can't get a life put together. It's trickling through my hands, and I can't stop drinking. And I can't stop drinking because what I started to talk about a minute ago. When I get in trouble and I get stopped. I run out of money. I'm in enough trouble where clearly, you know, I need to stop. And I can stop. Alcoholic. You know, anyone who says alcoholics can't stop, I don't know, man. I mean, I went in and out for 4 years. I'm a good stopper. Right? Staying stopped is a problem for me, right? But I stop, and 3 days later, I'm so screwed up inside that here's what I do. I'm just going to have one, right? I just need to take the edge off. I'm going to have one, maybe two, three at the most. I mean, I'm serious about this. I'm going to have one, maybe two, three at the most, no more than four, right? No, I am done at 4. And you guys, when I explain to you what happens, you tell me the craziest thing. You say, well, the reason you can't do that, Sheldon, is because of this thing called the phenomenon of craving, which I don't understand. Because you make it sound like something that for me it has never been. You say this cute little phrase. You say, you know, the phenomenon of craving is when you will drink against your will. I have never drank against my will ever. All right, maybe you have. I never have. Here's what happens to me, right? Because what that sounds like is I pour the third glass of scotch, set the bottle down, take the drink. Then the bottle grows arms and legs. Grabs me by the scruff of the neck and throws me on the table and starts pouring itself down my throat. The whole time I'm screaming, stop! Stop, you miserable bastard! I'm an alcoholic, for God's sakes! Here's what happens to me. I have one, maybe two. Three at the most, no more than four. No more than four. And then the phenomenon of craving hits, and here's how it presents. I change my mind. I have never drank against my will. I have changed my will, is what I have done. I have changed my mind. I've decided that 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 or 15 or however many it takes me to piss on the couch and hit on your mom is, you know, what I've decided I'm going to do instead, right? That's just what happens to me, you know? And so then that starts the cycle again and I show up again, you know? I'm so sorry I did it again.
And I go in and out and back and forth and in and out, and I can't stop. July 4th of 1996, I went to a 4th of July party in Dana Point, California, and I was a pig. I am an alcoholic. It is the only disease I have. I do not have any other diseases. I qualify to be here. I drink obnoxiously. And as a good friend of mine said once, had I known I was going to come to AA, I wouldn't have said yes to the drugs, but I didn't know, so I did, and I'm sorry. In AA, we're rigorously honest about everything, but we lie about whether or not we took drugs. Just so you know. Make sure you're not honest about that. They'll judge you for it. Anyway, right? So I'm... Don't tell lies, only from the podium. Yes, sponsor, I get you now. I'm with you. Anyway, right? So I'm in Dana Point, California, and I'm a pig, and I'm eating, drinking, smoking, snoring. I'm doing everything that I can to get myself as well as I can. And at the end of the night, I'm sleeping in my car, which is not unusual for me. It's an old Ford Escort hatchback. I'm laying in the back of the car, seats are down. I'm looking through the glass. There is no way I should have had a brain in my head that was conscious, but it was, and it was up, and it was telling me that you're a worthless piece of crap. You're no good. You did it again. This is what your life's going to look like. You said you weren't going to do this, but here you are doing it. You're always going to do it. You're a liar. You're a thief. You're no good. You're a puke. You're going to die, but you probably won't die quick. You'll probably live for 30 or 40 years, and this is how you'll live, right? And you'll be wetting yourself and puking on yourself and stealing from your family and lying to your employers. And anyone that becomes your friend, there'll be short-term friendships because you always let them down. It's what you do. You're disgusting. You're disgusting and you're worthless. And it's telling me this. And I tell you, I the thought came in my head that it's over. It's over. It doesn't shut off. It doesn't dull the pain. It doesn't go away. And it wasn't, if July the 3rd, it didn't work, and July, it worked, and it wasn't, it had been that way. It was the realization. I'd been going in and out of AA forever. I went back to Las Vegas from Dana Point where I was living, and I partied for a couple more weeks. A funny word, I partied. There's no balloons. Nobody's playing pin the tail on the donkey, for God's sakes, right? I mean, it's not really a party, but I call it partying, right? But I'm a disaster for another couple of weeks. And on July 16th of 1996, I went to bed, as I had done many, many times, begging to God that I do not believe in, that I don't have to wake up the next morning. That was a prayer that I made many, many times to a God that I did not believe in. July 17th, I woke up angry because I woke up. And I'm talking to this God that I don't believe in, and I'm asking why? And I heard a voice, and I tell you, it might have been remnants of the drugs, it might have been lack of sleep, it might have been the alcohol still gurgling in my brain, it might have been something bad that I ate the day before, I don't know, but I'd like to think it was the voice of God. I do not hear the voice of God on a regular basis. I would like to think this was the voice of God. And the voice said, you know where to go, go back to AA. And that's not what I wanted to hear. But I did. On July 17th of 1996, really, a shell of a man, I crawled into a place called the Kiss Club that's no longer there in Las Vegas, Nevada. It's a 24-hour AA club. I walked in there and I sat in the back of the room and it was over. I mean, life was over. It was over. There was nothing left for me. There was going to be no more joy, no more happiness. It was over. I was going to suffer with the miserable people of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know... This gentleman, Tom, stands up with 50 years. When I'm new in Alcoholics Anonymous, someone says they're 50 years sober. I'm thinking, you poor bastard. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Because I have a reference point of sobriety. It's 3, 4, 5, or 10 days. I think Tom's felt like that for 50 years, right? And I can't imagine what that would be like. And that's what I think you offer. I think you offer a place where I can sit around with, make friends with guys like Don and women like Mari, and we can sit around and say, oh, isn't this horrible? Yes, but we deserve it, right? And AA is going to be the punishment for our sins, right? That's what I feel like AA is going to be. And if I tell you that, you say, oh, it's not that bad. You know, Tom said it, and I know what he meant. He didn't mean what I heard. Right? But Tom says, well, you got to stay sober one day at a time. And he thinks it's good news. What I hear is you got to stay sober
one day at a time, 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 time. One long, miserable, painful day at a time, time, time.
Oh my God! You people are evil! And if I say anything to you and you say no, you don't, if that's too long, do it an hour at a time. What I hear is 60 miserable minutes. Tick, tick, tick. Oh! So I settle in for my prison sentence to suffer in AA's bleakness for as long as I can stand it. And do I think I'm going to stay? No. Why would I? I never have. I've come before. What I think is going to happen is I'm going to stay 8 or 10 or 15 days. You're going to buy me a few hamburgers and a packet of cigarettes. I might stack a chair or two. But eventually I'm going to leave because I always leave. Because what happens is the hole inside me opens up and the frustration starts and my head starts to run. And I just got to go. And I'm not going to burn my life down. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go and have one. Maybe two. Three at the most. No more than four. I shouldn't sleep more often. Oh, God help me. But I stayed there for a couple of days, and what happened was one noon meeting, a man walked in to a meeting that he doesn't usually attend. And God will use what, you know, we say, take my character defects, the good and the bad. Right? And God will leave some behind if he thinks those that can be, you know, the ones that get in the way of my usefulness. God will leave some that can be useful. This man was at that meeting that he doesn't usually attend because there was a girl there he was trying to see. All right? But he was at that meeting. And in that meeting, he focused on that meeting because that's the kind of man that he is. And he started to share at that meeting, and he said something that must have been said at meetings before. I just hadn't heard it. The Buddhists say, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And this man started to talk about, yeah, 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 I drank, and yeah, 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 I couldn't control how much I drank, and yeah, 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 I did embarrassing things when I drank, but that's not what I suffer from. I do suffer from the inability to control my alcohol, but that's not what causes me pain. What causes me pain is abstinence. When I try not to drink, that's when the pain begins for me. And he talked about loneliness and frustration and what it felt like. The phrase he used is what it feels like when the bag and the bottle end. That's what we treat in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I heard him. And I heard him because he was talking about loneliness, frustration, and fear. And I knew that he knew. I knew that he knew. I knew that he knew. But I knew he didn't feel that way anymore. And he didn't know because he'd read a book about it. He'd been there. He knew. But when he talked about it in a way where he had found a solution for that. And I went up to him after that meeting and I said to him that I need your help. I couldn't ask him to be my sponsor. It's like asking a girl to dance at the high school dance, right? I mean, some of you guys can pull that crap off, but not the short, fat, ugly Jew with a big nose. It's not, I mean, just, I ain't even, if I looked like Landis, it wouldn't have been a problem, right? But for me, there's no way, right? So I could, but he said to me, I will be your sponsor. And he has been my sponsor for over 21 years. He turned to that girl and he said, can't, sweetie, got to talk to this guy. Because that's the kind of guy that he is. A great member of Alcoholics Anonymous. An amazing member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He took me to his house for a book study that I still attend today. It's on Tuesday nights at his house. It's one of our home group meetings now. Our home group has encompasses that meeting now, but it's much older than our home group. He took me to a book study on Tuesday night. He took me to a detox meeting on Thursday afternoon, not as a client. I was 3 days sober, 4 days sober, not as a client, but to share in that panel. And I've been going to detox meetings, halfway houses, prisons, jails, institutions, Salvation Armies, ever since. And I've been involved in book studies and workshops and working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous ever since. Because as Tom said so beautifully, in the first 30 days in Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned everything I needed to know to stay sober. And what I started to do very quickly after that was try to figure out what parts of it I didn't need. Right? A friend of mine says all the time, he says, you know, I don't need all of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just don't know which parts I don't need, so I do it all. Because I ain't bright enough to figure out which ones are disposable. And you got me involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you got me in the step process of Alcoholics Anonymous, and here's how that looked for me. We talked about step one. Now, some of you guys have to do step one in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have to do step one in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. We had to talk for about 15 minutes about what my life had been like. There was nothing to write, nothing to study, nothing to read. It was a simple discussion. Hey, kid, what's it like when you drink? Oh, my God. Right? I can't do that, sponsor. Oh, okay, well, probably shouldn't do it. Well, why do you keep doing it? Can't stop. Boy, it sounds like you got alcoholism. Right? We talked about unmanageability for a minute, and this is what he said about unmanageability. We didn't focus on, if you come to me with 5 years sober, we'll have an unmanageability discussion, that I will dress up a step one that'll really be step six, right? It won't really be step one, but we talk about it as being step one. But he talked to me about a newcomer that couldn't stay sober, not sober unmanageability, drinking unmanageability. So he says to me, hey, have you ever tried to quit drinking? Well, of course I have. You know I have. I've talked to you about it. He goes, well, how many times? What do you mean how many times? I don't know. For over 3 years. I could stay sober about 8 or 10 days. Sometimes 2 days, sometimes 1 day, sometimes I leave at the break. I got 30 days twice. I lied about 60 days once. I mean, you know, I'm the guy that drinks again, right? That's who I am. I'm the guy that drinks again. But I don't know, probably about every 10 days. Probably on average 10 days. 10 days I can stay sober, then I drink again. 365 days in a year, I don't know what is that, 36 times a year, 36 times a year, I show up as a newcomer. 3 years plus, I don't know, about 100 times. About 100 times I've sworn I will never drink again and drank again, about 100 times. Wow. Wow, you might be powerless over alcohol, maybe. Maybe. You ever tried to quit? Yeah, 100 times tried to quit. When you tried to quit, did any of those times have anything in common? Was there a common thread every time you tried to quit? What are you talking about? I don't know. I mean, was it the same every time? Was there something that we can change that if we changed it, you'd be able to stay quit? What are you talking about? Well, for example, last time you drank, why did you get sober? What drove you to drink after you were sober? What made you pick up? I got an argument with my boss. Great, got an argument with your boss. Do you drink every time you argue with your boss? In fact, other way around, every time you drink, is it because you argue with your boss? 100 arguments with 100 bosses, that's why you drink. No. No. Okay, time before, why did you drink? Why did I drink? I don't know, got rejected by a girl. Okay, every single time you drank, was it because you got rejected by a girl? Well, more times than I'd like to admit. But not every time, right? I mean, I'm a loser, but not that big of a loser. Well, what do they have in common? What do your relapses, which is a strange word, right? But what do your going back to drinkings all have in common? I don't know. He said, I do. Okay, what? Every single time you picked up a drink after a period of abstinence, you were as physically sober as you are right now. Physically sober, you decided it would be a good idea for your future for you to take beverage alcohol and pour it in your body. Whoever's making decisions for your life is a terrible manager. Sounds to me like you, your life is unmanageable by you. Step one, done. In the bag. Well, that's good, but I already know that. No new information there, and I can't do step two, not doing step two. There is no step two, won't do step two. Why won't you do step two? Can't do step two. Can't do step two, can't do step three. Not doing either of those two steps, not doing them, can't do them. Won't do them. Not doing two, not doing three. No way. So what else you got? What do you mean you won't do two and you won't do three? Why won't you do two and why won't you do three? Well, it's very simple. I told you I came from a Jewish home. That's not really true. I came from an atheist Jewish home. Now, what that means is we're Jews, but we know we're wrong. The only people on the planet that are more wrong than us are our crazy Christian neighbors. I just like to point out, some of you laughed at the Jew joke, didn't laugh at the Christian joke. You have problems, inventory to write, calls to your sponsors to make. My mom, we were culturally Jewish, not religiously Jewish. We would do some of the festivals and we'd do some of the rigmarole, but we weren't, there was no spirit in our home. My mom would be stood, you know, we'd be getting ready to go out. She would say, Sheldon, religion is the opiate of the masses. It's for fools and children. Now get dressed, we're going to temple. In the sect of Judaism that we grew up in, it was a bizarre, but it was a religious sect. We would walk to temple, right? Now, that because of urban sprawl, the temples were in what is now the rough neighborhood, and the Jews had run to the suburbs. It's 5 miles to temple. There are 5 mile Jews. That's what I called them. They'd walk 5 miles to temple. They are the 5 mile Jews. We would take the bus to 3 blocks away, look tired, and walk the rest. I am a 3-block Jew. It's my level of commitment. Some of you can't stay sober because you're 3-block AA members. Five-mile AA member. 3-block Jew, 5-mile AA member. But I can't do the Jewish faith, right? I just can't. There was a guy at my school, a guy, his name was Alfred Israel. He was the vice principal. He got violent with me on several occasions. I was a bad representation of the Jewish community. We went to a Jewish private school, and we were the kids that were there on the scholar. We were the freebies. We were the poor kids that were allowed in. I was loud, and I was obnoxious. I was a bad student. And he hated me, and I hated him. And he represented to me all the authority in the Jewish faith, and there was no way that I could hang out with him. There was another guy that he was in charge of the choir. He was what's called a cantor, a chazan. This guy got in trouble for messing with little girls and little boys in the choir. Now, I tell you that because I want the Catholics to know it's not only you. The Jews have that problem also, right? I want you, little identification, right? Little identification, right? And I hated him. And I hated him too, right? But I hated him too. And I can't do the Jewish faith and I can't do the Christian faith. And besides, I know what you mean. When you say God as he may express himself in the group conscience, I know who you mean. Just like you'd know who they meant if you were trying to get sober in a Muslim country and they said that to you and you wouldn't be able to do their God. I can't do my God, can't do your God, can't do God not doing step two, can't do step two, can't turn my will in my life, can't do step three, no two, no three, can't do it. What else you got? He says to me, let's look at the big book just for fun. And he opens the big book, page 47 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it asks a question. And it says that you're supposed to ask the new man, do you now believe? Which I said, I don't. I don't believe. He goes, I know you don't believe. I don't believe. You're asking me, do I now believe? The answer is no, I don't believe. He says it's a comma, not a period. Can we read the rest of the sentence? Okay. Do I now believe or am I even willing to believe in a power greater than myself? What does that mean? Am I even willing to believe that maybe, just maybe, there might be a power greater than myself? Am I willing to believe that it's possible that maybe there might be some kind of God? I mean, probably not, right? I mean, if you're asking me to make a commitment, the answer is no. But is it possible that maybe there might be a God? Maybe, possibly,
Perhaps. I mean, no, yes, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I suppose it's possible. Anything's possible. I suppose, yes, it's possible. I want to be clear that I doubt it. Right? But it's possible. So he reads the next sentence. He said, as soon as a man says he does believe, which I don't, or is even willing to believe, which I guess I am, we emphatically ensure him he's on his way. What does that mean? It means, yeah, baby, you're done. Step two, it's over. In the bag. Nothing to write. No essays. No long to go home and think about. So you're done. If you're willing to believe that maybe, possibly, there might be a God, even though you doubt it, you're done with step two. So tonight, if you're working on step two, we just did it together. I said, okay, well, now what? He said, say the prayer. Just say the goddamn prayer. Get on your knees and pray, boy. Why? Because as Shoemaker says in AA Comes of Age, Alcoholics Anonymous is the scientific approach to spirituality. What does that mean? The scientific approach. Well, if a scientist was to try and prove if something was right or something was wrong, what he would do is set up a set of circumstances that would try and replicate the thing that he thinks he's trying to prove is true. Then without an opinion, he would sit back and watch the results. And then he would say, yeah, that was right, or no, that was wrong, without an opinion vested in it. And that's what we ask the new guy to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We ask you to act as if God exists. And then we'll check the results periodically in your life, and you can make a decision of whether or not it's helping. It's really that simple. So say the goddamn prayer. Say the prayer, write the list. Say the prayer, write the list. Say the prayer, write the list, share the list. I'm not sharing the list. I didn't spend much time on the street, but I tell you, I learned one thing. Deny, deny, deny. Well, how's it going, kid? Not so good. So write the list and share the list. Don't worry about 6 and 7. Nobody understands 6 and 7. 8 and 9, I'm not doing those. He says, why? I said, they're expensive. He said, they don't want your money. Oh, thank God. They want their money back. I told this one old timer, I said, you know, I did the math of what I'm making now, right? Paying these amends back, it's going to take me 30 years. He said, you know what you'll have when you're done? I said, what? He said, 30 years. Oh, well, thank you for your support. Pay the money. Pay the money. 10 and 11, they're confusing. Again, half the people in the room think they're doing 10 when they're really doing 11, right? And some of you are laughing, going, yeah, and some of you are like, what? Ask one of the ones that's not, and they'll show you. You'll go, wow, that really is 11. I had no idea, right? What? Look at that. Look at that. Step 12. Let me tell you something about step 12. If you're new, don't worry about step 12. And I tell you why you don't worry about step 12. Because if you go through Alcoholics Anonymous and you live the process the way that I've lived it, by the time you get to step 12, let them try and stop you. I mean, let them try. Let them try and stop you talking about Alcoholics Anonymous and talking about this program and talking about the magic here and talking about the change in your life. Let them try. No one will have to ask you to do step 12 if you're an active, everyday member of Alcoholics Anonymous whose spirit has been changed by the power that they found here. They didn't believe in when they got here. Don't you worry about step 12. You'll be begging for opportunities to share your story about this magical and mystical program called Alcoholics Anonymous. In other words, take the process. I took the process. How do you do it? How do you sum it up? How do you explain the magic and the mystery and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous? We try. There's a great big
trend in AA right now, of which I've been sucked into and then pulled myself back from and sucked into, where we try to tell you to dot the I's and cross the T's, and as long as the period's in the right place and you have the correct number of columns and you do everything perfectly, then you'll have an experience. But it's nonsense. Right? Bill Wilson, page 13, right? Bill Wilson on page 14 has a spiritual experience. On page 13, he does a false step. And if you read it, it's all wrong. He doesn't do it anywhere close to the way he tells me to do it when he gets to page 59. He just doesn't. Right? It just doesn't. But he does one and have, because it doesn't matter, because God is in the spaces, is in the gaps and in the darkness and in the mysteries. In the middle of the night, when I wasn't paying attention, somehow against my will, God creeped into my life and made himself known to me because I took actions I did not believe would work. And my goodness, I don't know how, but poof, here we are in Atlanta. Right? Right? Against my will. I mean, that's God. So, I tell you, I may never have drank against my will, but God showed up against my will. I'll tell you, that's something that happened that I wasn't planning on, right? I mean, just an amazing deal. What a. I almost quoted Jerry and said, what a long, strange trip it's been, right? But what a fantastic and fabulous journey through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, from a broken man that wished he was dead and couldn't die even though he wanted to a guy now that finds himself in the middle of a home group that he loves, surrounded by people that he cares about, married to a woman that he adores, with a son that is the center of his universe, with a new business that he's so excited about the future, I can't stand myself. This man that was became this man that is. And I tell you, you can't explain it. I want to be clear about something. I am not a miracle. I am not a miracle. I am a participant in a magical and mystical miracle-based program. And that program has affected my life in magical and mystical ways. And if you're new, I implore you, if you suffer from what I suffer from, do what I've done. Go where I've gone and be where I am and do what I do. Participate in Alcoholics Anonymous as if you are a dying man. I love what Don said today in the workshop. AA is not negotiable. It is the center of my life. If you are in my life and you have been around me for more than 15 or 20 minutes, you know I'm a member of AA, because what the hell else am I going to talk about? Right? I mean, there ain't much else going on, right? I mean, there just isn't. There just isn't. I want to share a quick story with you as the clock is running down. I told you that my dad leaving was the worst thing that ever happened to me. And I don't have time to go into how and why the steps taught me this. But I want you to hear something, because it's important. I had to make amends to my dad for many different things that had happened over the years. We made amends to each other, and then there was problems. Then we made amends, and then there was problems. And one of these problems happened when I was about 14, 15 years sober. And my dad was leaving Las Vegas. He'd moved to Vegas. We'd become close enough for him to move to Vegas. And he was participating in my son's life in a daily basis. And my son loved his grandfather. And my dad decided to move back to England. He met a girl. And he decided to move back to England. And he moved back to England. And on his way out the door, him and I had some business together. And he left me with all the debt. I got stuck. My son, the lie was that he broke my son's heart. Right? And if you affect my son, that's one thing. And he hurt my wife. And if you hurt my wife, that's one thing. But he got in my pocket. And that's a whole nother thing. Now it's getting serious. Right? Truth is, he didn't break my son's heart. My son was... this has got to be longer ago. My son was probably 6. My son's 15 now. It's 9 years ago. I was probably 12 years sober. My son looked up at his grandfather. My son has 2 loving parents that adore him. He is secure in his home. He said, "Are you leaving, Grandpapa? Have fun." Right, but what happened inside me was that he left me when I was 2, and now he's leaving my son when my son's 6. He's doing it again, that son of a bitch. I hate him. And on the way out, he took some money as he left, and I went to my sponsor, and I told my sponsor, this is your fault. You made me make amends to him. You made me get close to him. You made me let him back in my family. He got my son's heart, he got my heart, he got my wife's heart, and he got me for about 20 grand. And I think you owe me the 20 grand. And I was mad. I mean, I was not kidding. I was furious that AA had done this to me. And I told my sponsor, I'm never talking to that man again. Don't ever ask me to. I will never speak to him again. We are done. And he said to me, that's fine. You can do that if you'd like. But if you're going to do that, I want you to be honest about what that means. What that means is your dad's old. You might live another 5 years. You will punish him severely. He'll have nothing to do with his son or his grandchild or his daughter-in-law. He will suffer for it. You will make him pay. And then he'll die. You, however, will live for probably another 30 years. And for 30 years, you'll be haunted by the ghost of the fact that you come from those kind of people. You've got his blood in your veins. Your dad let you down. Your dad didn't love you. Your dad's no good. Your dad's this. Your dad's that. It'll keep you up at night, and you'll suffer with that for 30 years. There'll be no therapy, no steps, no nothing, nothing you can do. You will suffer, and then you will die. Your son, however, will live 30 years beyond that, probably a total of another 60 or 70 years. And for 60 or 70 years, your son will know that the blood in his veins is the blood of no good, rotten sons of bitches. He'll know that that grandfather that he loved so much when he was a kid was a worthless piece of garbage, and he'll learn all those lessons. He said, and do you think you'll ever let your son down? Oh, come on. I mean, if I've learned anything of my life in sobriety, come on. Come on. Do I think I'll ever let my son down? Of course I will. He said, what do you want to teach your son? Do you want to teach your son that when his dad lets him down, he writes him off like yesterday's garbage? Or do you want to teach him to seek and search for forgiveness for his father? Well, that ain't no fun. So I got to make amends to my dad. Got to find a way to make amends to my dad. Truth about my dad is my dad never really meant to hurt anyone. He hurt a lot of people. But he never meant to hurt anyone. My dad is not an alcoholic. But my dad is a selfish, self-centered guy. My dad's focused on how he feels and how much fun he's having. I mean, gosh, who among us isn't? Right? My dad is focused on how much fun he's having, what's going on in his favor. My dad saw a pretty girl when I was 2, chased after her. Saw another pretty girl when my son was 6, chased after her. My dad is just a guy that wants to enjoy his life, and he makes mistakes along the way, and people get hurt. He couldn't have done any different. That was his nature. I was mad at him for not being able to do something he wasn't capable of doing. It was his nature. In essence, my dad did the best he could with the tools he had at his disposal. And I'm really glad I didn't learn that at 2 years sober. I'm glad it took me to 12. Because if I'd have said that to him, what I would have said is, Dad, I know that you did the best you could with the tools you had at your disposal. It's not your fault. You're just not good enough to be my dad. It's not your fault that you're weak and you're worthless and you didn't do it on purpose. And we both wish I had a better dad. And even though it's not, I forgive you because I'm a better man than you. So I couldn't say that. I'm trying to figure out how to let my dad off the hook and how to make amends to my dad, and then I get the phone call. He's sick. He's sick and he's having surgery. He's got about a 40% chance of living through, and I got to go be with my dad while he has the surgery, and I got to make amends, and I don't know how to make amends. Until right before I got by his bed, and then God gave me the way. And I sat with my dad, and I said, Dad, I said, I want you to know that I'm really glad you were my father. He says, what are you talking about? I was a lousy father. And he was. And he's a smart guy. I mean, there's no fooling him. But if he didn't know, I had been this close to him on many occasions with spit coming out of my mouth and told him, you're a lousy goddamn father. So it was no surprise to him that I thought, right? I mean, he said, I was a lousy dad. I said, Dad, that's not what I mean. Dad, when I meet people, they think I got a pretty good sense of humor. And you know, Mom, not that funny. That's a gift of your DNA and the time that I spent with you. Because you're my dad, I am a stamp out of you. In many ways, we're the same. And because you're my dad, I have a sense of humor, and you help teach me and nurture that. I'm a great salesman. It's done me a great service, and that is because you're my dad. I'm a great salesman from 16 to 18 and even beyond. You taught me and trained me and taught me. He wasn't an English professor. He was a salesman. He taught me and trained me and helped me and nurtured me to become a salesman. And Dad, that's a gift. And I'm so great. I love my life. And my life is because of you. And you're a great dad. And I want you to know I'm glad that you are my father. And he put his head down and he cried. And when he brought his head back up, he said to me, son, he said, you know, I might die. Even if the surgery doesn't go well, I'm still dying. Even if it goes well, I'm still dying. And I don't know what happens next. He said, I'm not a real spiritual man. I don't know if I go to heaven or hell. I don't know if the lights go out and nobody's home or if I get another shot at this world in reincarnation. But if I get to come back through this world, I hope I get to come back the kind of man I've watched you grow into in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not big on the inner child crap, but I tell you somewhere inside me, there's a little 2-year-old boy that got his daddy back that day. And that was magical and mystical and beautiful. When my dad passed, I held his hand. I was the last man to touch him. I was with him when he took his last breath. I told you the worst thing that ever happened to me was that my dad left me when I was 2 years old. And I told you I love my life. I love my life in Las Vegas. I have an amazing life. And if you're new, I know you're really happy for me. But I do. I love my life. I have a great life in Las Vegas, and I love my life. And my life exists for one reason and one reason alone. One reason and one reason alone that my life looks like it does in Las Vegas. Because my dad left when I was 2 years old. Because when my dad left when I was 2 years old, he moved from Leeds to London, London to Toronto, Toronto. He snuck across the border, married an American girl, settled in Southern California, and that's how I got out of England. Had I never got out of England, I never would have gone to California, spent some time in California, and ran away to Las Vegas, where I was to meet my wife, who I adore. I'd have another wife. I don't think she'd be as cool as the one I got. Maybe she would, maybe she wouldn't. But it wouldn't be her, and I love her. I wouldn't have my son. He's half me, half her. Might have another son. Wouldn't be that son. Wouldn't be that son. Might have gotten sober in AA, but not in that home group with that sponsor. Wouldn't be friends with Don and Mari and Jerry and John and Kathy and John and the rest of you and Amanda and the rest of you that I've met on this journey. And Mike, it wouldn't look like it does today. And I love my life, and my life exists because of one thing that my dad left when I was 2 years old. What is the best thing that he did for me or the worst thing that he did for me? I don't know. And if I can learn one lesson, and that lesson is that I don't know, I got a shot at a happy life. If I can learn the lesson that I don't know, I got a shot at allowing God in the darkness, in the creases, in the mystery, in the smoke, and in the myth. If I can learn the lesson that I don't know, then I got a shot at taking the bounty and the fruit and the wonderment and the amazement that God has given me already. As Chamberlain would say, what are you praying for? He already gave you it all. The world of abundance in which we live. If I can just admit that I don't know, I got a shot. I'm so grateful to be an active everyday member in this beautiful program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so grateful to be here with you in Atlanta. I'm so grateful to be in my home group. I'm so grateful to have found the blessings I've found in Alcoholics Anonymous. I lied. I'm going to tell you one more quick story.
The biggest lie in Alcoholics Anonymous. One more quick story, and I'm done. And I'm done. A few years ago, it's Christmas. My wife asked me to go to the grocery store for her. I say, what the hell? It's Christmas, right? I go to the market for it, and it's Christmas in the market. There's Christmas music playing, Christmas, Christmas, Christmas. There's decorations up. Everybody's like, Happy Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. It's Christmas. We should all be happy, for God's sakes, right? I get the stuff, get in the line, and in the line, there's a woman in line, and we now live in a nice neighborhood. And she's a nice neighborhood woman in her little Christmas jewelry. She's got the little sweater with the little Christmas tree brooch, right? The little Christmas packages. You've all got a set. I know you do, right? Little green boxes that dangle, right? She's got her. She's Christmas. And the son is in the carriage, and he's all Christmased out. And, Merry Christmas. Hi, Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. As we get through the line, the kid sees the candy, right? And the kid says, Mommy, can I have some chocolate? And she says, oh, no, honey, don't worry. You don't want any. When we get home, we can have an apple. The kid says, Mommy, I don't want an apple. I want some chocolate. Can I have some chocolate? She goes, no, honey, no chocolate. He goes, chocolate, Mommy, I want chocolate. Mommy, give me some chocolate. I want chocolate. I want some candy. Can I have some candy? I want some candy. Chocolate, Mommy. I want chocolate. Mommy, can I have some chocolate, please, Mommy? I thought, oh, my God, it sounds like my head. I'm walking along minding my own business. My head says, you know what would be a good idea? A beer. I say, we're not having a beer. Come on, let's have a beer. Have one. Come on, I want a beer. Let me have a beer. I want a beer. Beer. Give me beer. I want a beer. I want a beer. Now, she gets restless, irritable, and discontent. Right? She's no longer the Merry Christmas elf, right? She's like, would you hurry up with those groceries, right? And she's getting frustrated. He's frustrated. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God, right? She's offering him an apple. It's like when I say to my head, listen, you don't need a beer. Here's what we'll do. When we're done here, we'll go to a meeting. My head says, I don't want a meeting. I want a beer. Give me a beer. I want a beer. I want a beer. I tell you what we'll do. We'll call our sponsor. He's not my sponsor. He's your sponsor. I want a beer. You know what she did? She bought him some candy. If she hadn't, I would have. It was Christmas. I have a 15-year-old son. He hasn't always been 15. When he was 2 or 3 years old, he would have tantrums, as they all do. I'd call my sponsor and say, my son is definitely an alcoholic. 3 years old, he's already selfish, self-centered, won't listen to anything I tell him, screams and yells when he doesn't get his own way. My sponsor says, your 3-year-old does not act like an alcoholic. Your alcoholic friends act like 3-year-olds. But he would have a tantrum, and we would go to the VCR. I'm now dating myself. For the young kids, that was a big box that would slide into a machine. And on that VCR, there would be Barney, the big purple dinosaur. I love you, you love me, right? My kid, who's in the middle of a tantrum, he's like, aah! You plug in the VCR, Barney comes on, and he goes, vroom. It's like kiddie crack, right there. Right? Just look at the dinosaur. Now, I'm not trying to compare AA to Barney. But, if you got a sponsor and a home group and a job in your home group and you're actively working the steps and you're in the middle of this process and you haven't stalled at 5 or you haven't done 5, and stalled at 9, and you're not screwing around, not really doing 10 and 11, and you're actively trying to find how you can actively see the problem of 6 and give it up to God in 7. If you're doing AA, and you're sponsoring guys, and you're carrying this message, I mean, if you're a 5-mile AA member, right, if you're doing the deal, your head says to you,
Hey, let's have a beer. You go, no, and you keep going with your day. And you recoil from it like you would a hot flame, and we are immune from alcohol. If we are active in AA, it is a guarantee that if you're involved in this program at a serious level, that you will get to stay sober one day at a time, as is proved by our friend Tom. God bless you in your 50 years, sir, and thank you for still being here to forge the path for guys like me. For that, I am grateful. So as I leave you, I will just say this. I love you. I love you. Thank you for my life.